Okay, apparently there's some charts and things which people at the back may have trouble reading if you've got bad eyesight. So if you want to move forward, then maybe you should now. But I'll introduce Nick and Duncan. They've written, they're both with Towers Watson, although originally Duncan was with Towers Perrin and Nick was with Watson Wyatt. So, but they're both working together under the same firm now. And they've been working a lot on these sorts of issues, and most recently they prepared quite an extensive report for IFSA on some of the highlighting some of the challenges of a government provision of an annuity. So this is really sort of a continuation of some of the work they've been doing there. Nick will get up first and he'll talk. They'll do a presentation for about half an hour and then we'll take questions and things. So hand over to Nick. Thank you.
Thanks, Barry, and thanks for coming along. What we want to do is take you through some of the work that Duncan and I separately over many years and more particularly recently have been working on in relation to retirement products, retirement strategies, and the outcomes from a retiree perspective. So I think we've heard a lot at the conference so far about retirement products, the next generation. We'll be talking about those in a bit of detail. Some of it has been from a provider perspective, what's involved in offering these products, what are the hedging risks, that sort of thing. We're looking at it from the other side. What do these mean to members? Are they a valuable addition to a retirement portfolio to members? Those are the questions that we're drilling down to try and not so much give answers to, but show ways that we think you can get answers to these questions. So we'll be walking through them fairly quickly. We'll have some comments on the bells and whistles on some of the more exotic products, if you like the Money for Life type products towards the end. But I'll be showing you a process based on some modelling that actually shows how we think trustees or retirees need to think about whether these products are a good idea. And just before I move on to that, I mean, one of the issues you see with these more complex products, the Money for Life type products, is there's obviously a guarantee or an insurance element to that, and so there's a fee attached to it. And I've heard even in discussions, talking among financial planners and that the like, that fee, it's 1.5%. That's a lot. And my reaction to that is, well, I don't know whether that's a lot or not. I mean, let's assume a retiree is interested in this sort of a product. What does it mean to say 1.5% is a lot to pay? You can't just get the answer to that by looking at a PDS or comparing it to the asset management fee for an unprotected product. You need to do something like this, we think. So that was really the impetus for us to say, how do these products actually stack up? I'm going to start just with some basics. The earlier work that I mentioned Duncan and I had both done independently covered some of this territory. One of the charts, this chart's from some work that we'd done in previous years, and you may have seen it before in various guises. This is just looking at the risk of ruin, if you like, from an investor in an account-based pension. So starting point, what most retirees obviously do is an account-based pension strategy. They draw money to an assumed target. So the single choice they make, having decided to devote all their money to an account-based pension, is how do I invest that money over my retirement period? What we're seeing here is, and the shape's fairly similar regardless of the various sort of variations to income that you can make, from starting at 65, before you get to about mid-80s, it really doesn't matter too much how you invest. You're quite unlikely to run out of money. But as you go past that age, 85 to 90 and beyond, you get this divergence. And for those of you too far away, what we're seeing there is that the low growth, 0% is a green line, for instance. So the low growth options give you the highest risk of ruin, highest risk of exhausting your account. The low growth options do better. The high growth options do better. But my key takeaway for you from that chart is more that under any strategy, as the longevity kicks in, you're attaining this significant risk of ruin. So you, in other words, as I think Duncan mentioned this morning, you can't just invest your way out of this problem. That's what most retirees are doing. But, you know, the question to us is, you know, it doesn't appear to be enough because you still are carrying these material risks of running out of money in the longer term. So what we then move to is, and what's new about this analysis, is looking at more than just an account-based pension strategy. What we've brought in here is two different families of products. And if I start with the left-hand side there, we've added in lifetime annuities, and as you'll see, we've got various strategies using those products that we put into the portfolio. And then in between, we've got what we call the sequence of returns or next generation type products, and these are the money for life or variable annuity type products that have been discussed quite a lot at this conference so far. We're going to assume a fair bit of knowledge about those products, so we're not going to walk you through exactly all the detail, although Duncan will have something to say about some of the features to watch that perhaps sort of fly below the radar on some of those products. But the key point for the moment is, I think, to take away is that they really are trying to capture some the best of both worlds, if you like, of both the account-based pension and the lifetime annuity. So we see them as sitting in the middle on this spectrum of full market exposure to full income protection. So I'm going to walk through these. I'll go more quickly through some of them than others just so we can get to the, I guess, the more interesting ones. But let's start with a familiar one, and you'll understand the sort of metrics we're using here. We've set up a retiree starting with $150,000. We're targeting an income of $26,000. All in dollars, you'll see, are AWE indexed. And we're putting them in a 70-30 growth defensive allocation. And all the numbers you'll see are inclusive of the age pension. So the means tested age pension is included in all of these. It's a straight line there, but when the income gets bigger, it would slope down in line with the means test. Sorry, we've got a problem there, I think. Sorry, there are lines there, but this is where I said that they're very faint, so I'll just move on quickly from that one. They're very faint. The message here is that an accounts-based pension, we know how that behaves. You run out of money, as we showed earlier, about 85, and your account will run down over time such that when you run out of income, you also run out of assets. The twin metrics we're looking here are what your income is and how much you've got to dip into for health or death benefits, if you like, along the way. Let's look at one that's got some numbers we can see. This is now a lifetime annuity strategy. The strategy we've used here is not just simply going and purchasing a lifetime annuity. We're actually diverting only 30% of our account towards the annuity. The remainder is invested still in the account-based pension with a 70-30 strategy. So what you see there, and again, apologies, it's come out far too faint, but as you would expect, that brings forward the period at which you run out of income, because what you've really done there is you've taken some money from a growth-oriented strategy and invested it in an annuity which is underlying return is lower growth. So you do fall from your target income more quickly, but as you can see, well, you can't see, but that the blue line there is at a level above just the minimum age pension. So you've swapped some income early in your retirement to income later in your retirement by purchasing the annuity. And if you look then at what happens to the available assets, should you die, or if you need have unexpected health expenses and the like, you've got a lower than you would with a full account-based pension strategy. You've got a lower amount available at any time. What you've done is you've turned 30% of your money into an illiquid asset from day one, And while there is some sort of convergence of that of those two strategies over time, because you don't have to draw quite so much to reach your target income, you're always below. So you're always worse off if your aim is always to have as much money at your disposal at all times, and that's your only objective. Then clearly you wouldn't be heading this way. But like most, we think for most retirees, it's a trade-off between income and liquid assets, and so this is a step towards having more income protection towards the tail of retirement. Look quickly at a couple of other annuitisation scenarios. Here is where we're still using lifetime annuities, but we are now not making the purchase entirely at retirement. We are gradually annuitising over the period from age 65 to age 90. So there's plenty of different, obviously different glide paths you could use. We've assumed this retiree puts 5% of their money in at age 65 and then gradually works up to a point where every 5 years they buy some more, convert some more to annuity, and finally at age 90, whatever money is left in their account, they fully annuitise. And if you look on the income chart, which we see there, you're seeing you're getting marginally better outcomes based on that strategy compared to just single point-in-time annuity. And there's a couple of reasons for that. This is all, I should have mentioned earlier, this is all based on our stochastic modelling, and what we're looking at is the median outcomes. Duncan will be showing you some of the tail outcomes later. But that stochastic modelling is not just on growth and defensive returns, but also on the purchase price of the annuity. So because you're getting a bit of diversification of the annuity purchase price here, that may be what's giving you that little bit of that income improvement over time. And then if you look at this represents what your liquid assets are over that same period, you're actually seeing a reasonable amount of improvement over a pure like single point in time annuitisation strategy. So you can see the dips there are when you're actually reaching the end of another 5 year period and buying more annuity, which drops it down. But at all times, it's above what you would have at if you just simply purchased the annuity up front. So that shows, you know, that, or at least indicates the strategy of not a one time annuity purchase but a gradual annuitisation seems to have some merit. Now we're going to look at something that is not actually available in the marketplace at the moment, but we are hopeful that won't be the case for long. And this is deferred annuities. And to be honest, in doing this work, I wasn't aware of the fact that not just that they weren't popular, like I guess immediate annuities are in the marketplace, but the law actually prevents life officers from offering these on any tax effective basis, because the minimum drawdown rules actually apply to these products as well. So if you want to have a deferral period, which by definition means that it's not paying an income there, then they don't meet the minimum drawdown rules. So that's an anomaly. I guess it seems to have crept into the marketplace. I do understand the government, I mean, this was covered in the Henry report, and I understand the government, or at least Chris Bowen anyhow, has made some noises suggesting that will be something they'll look to lift in the shorter term. Hopefully. So anyhow, we've gone and done the modelling on the assumption that these would become available on a tax-effective basis. So what we've done here, and again, there's obviously any number of versions you could model, this is looking at the retiree takes 10% of their initial balance, rolls that into a deferred annuity paying at 85, and then the rest goes back into the 70-30 allocated pension. What we see there, in first of all, in income terms, we see your income drops off under that model a little bit before the annuitisation strategies, or the lifetime annuity strategies rather, but again, giving a better income in the tail than either of those two. So we're seeing some good result there from an income point of view. And then if you compare that on the account balance available point of view, you're seeing again, better than immediate annuitisation and, you know, comparable, it's a smoother line, but comparable under to the gradual annuitisation strategy. So, again, lots of parameters you could vary, but we're just trying to draw some broad conclusions here. And, I mean, both of these to us seem to have certainly warrants further investigation as against, I suppose, what often gets talked about is simply just going and putting it in as a one-off annuity at retirement age. Okay, I'm going to hand over to Duncan and we'll be back for questions.
Thanks, Nick. The missing piece on this is then what we've termed for purposes of this presentation, the next generation products. We've heard a lot talked about some of these at the forum already. In the market currently, it's the INGA type product, it's the Macquarie type product. I understand AXA have just sort of formally announced theirs this week. Who knows, there may well be some others coming in the fullness of time. We don't want to get into what the detail of what's going on underneath the bonnet with these things today. It's really about what are they deliver in terms of outcomes for retirees. But just by way of a brief recap, as hopefully many are aware, they combine key aspects of account-based pensions and annuities, so you still retain market exposure, you get an underpin of a lifetime income guarantee, but crucially in terms of their proposition, also retaining ongoing access to your remaining account balance, or at least that portion which is still in the account balance, account-based pension. So the guarantee fees that you're paying along the way, if you come out of the guarantee early, there's nothing paid to you in respect of, if you like, that part of the product. I should emphasise that we're not seeking to model any particular provider's product design here. I've made the observation before that, at least up until the start of this week, there are only two products in the market, but they were already devilishly difficult to compare. They do very different things underneath the bonnet for different ticket prices on the guarantee. So what we've elected for is a simpler design, which is probably has rather more similarity with the INGA product than the Macquarie product. We've modelled a 5% per annum protected floor, and we've assumed that protected floor can ratchet up periodically with improved with upside market performance. Again, a feature of both of the products in the market. But we have modelled a higher guarantee fee. The reason for that is because we're modelling here a 70-30 asset mix throughout everything we're doing. From memory, the highest growth exposure you could sign up to in the INGA product is 60%, I think it is. And depending on what growth asset exposure you choose, your guarantee fee varies. So if you think about it in terms of it is higher, but it's comparable with the sorts of guarantee fees, in my view, that are around in the market, albeit from a relatively limited selection of providers. There are some very important features. I'm not sure whether you can see them all on there. I'll come back to them in a minute. Regarding the Macquarie product, which makes for a much more difficult comparison again. So their guarantee fee is, I think, 1.1%, but their proposition is very different. What they're guaranteeing is different, and I'll come back to that later. But the next generation product here, what we're assuming is that there would be a blend of 50% of a retiree's balance remaining in a vanilla account-based pension, and the other 50% put into the next generation product. The reason for assuming a mix is because of the drawdown constraints on the guaranteed product version. And so we're trying to say, well, for a retiree who's trying to draw to achieve a certain target income for as long as they can, if they put it all into a guaranteed product, and the guarantee will end up not being worth very much because each time they draw more than they're allowed, then the guarantee itself gets reset. So at some point, I think there's got to be a blend between an account-based, a non-guaranteed account-based and a guaranteed version. And we've assumed a 50-50 mix for the purposes of everything that's up here. Clearly, one could look at different mixes and you get a different set of outcomes. But in all other respects, it's the same. It's fundamentally the same account-based pension that's being modelled, the same asset mix. It's just with the portion that's in the guarantee product, there's an additional impost of the guarantee fee coming off the product annually, albeit in return for that protected floor. So what you can see on both... Sorry, let me go back, actually. It's easier to see it there. With the next generation product combination, you're seeing an earlier drop-off of income compared with the various annuitisation strategies. Broadly, and we tried to choose it to deliver this so that at the point that it drops off, the sort of level of income that it is paying is comparable with the other strategies. But what you see there is that it actually decays away faster. And the reason for that is these annuitisation strategies, they're all assuming CPI-linked annuities. The next generation products in the market at the moment, whilst there is a protected floor, once the income starts to be paid, the guaranteed income starts to be paid, it's a level. Essentially, it's a level annuity. I think Richard correctly characterised it earlier this morning as, you know, they are contingent lifetime annuities. I think I'd characterise them as they're contingent deferred lifetime annuities. Whether they pay or not depends on the investment performance. But once these things start paying, I mean, what the provider's left with is purely a lifetime annuity. In at the moment, given the product designs, a level lifetime annuity. It is, yes. Sorry that that's not quite as clear as we would like. A point to draw out, though, is that whilst it's slightly underperforms, at least in this combination on the income side, when you look at the available assets, it's doing rather better. And what you're seeing is it starts at a higher level. That's essentially, by definition, where the account-based pension starts as well. It does decay away, coming towards the annuitisation strategy. But the reason it kicks along there along the bottom is because once your 50% in a vanilla account-based pension is gone, it's gone. And once you get to that point, well, the way we've modelled this is you're then restricted to only being able to take the income that is allowed under the guaranteed product without interfering with the guarantee itself. So it's, in essence, it means that the maximum you can take within the guarantee rules or the rules of the guarantee won't enable you to deliver target income, but will be at a level which means that the actual assets themselves do stretch out a little bit longer. Now, clearly, if you put in a different mix, maybe a 60-40 rather than 50-50, you'd see a slightly different mix of outcomes between the income delivered for the retiree and the progression of available assets. Covered that already. As Nick mentioned, all of that was median scenarios, and one of the key propositions of certainly the next generation products, to my mind, is what they do for you in the tail, the bad tail, given the guarantee that is being purchased. So before getting to that, just thought I'd show some good outcomes. So this is, I think this is actually a 95th percentile. Don't worry too much about what's going on the left-hand side of this chart. This is where the drawdown rules, the minimum drawdown rules, are force you under good asset performance to take more income than you might have anticipated under your target. I think the real action is what's going on the right-hand side, which, as you can see, on good outcomes, all of the annuitisation strategies or the partial annuitisation strategies actually still do better than the next generation product. Now, that's perhaps not surprising given the proposition. The particularly surprising one, though, is the best performing there is actually that gradual annuitisation strategy. But the reason that's doing so well in this scenario is, can be seen on this chart, it's the one whose available assets are falling away fastest. I mean, if you think about it, what we have in there is essentially a hard-coded rule for purchasing annuities every fifth year, regardless of how well your asset performance is doing. So in a very good scenario, your assets have gone up very well. You're just purchasing much higher lifetime income through the annuitisation, but at the expense of driving down your account balance faster. So again, there are trade-offs to be had there. The main point is that the available assets, and this is something to draw out, if you compare purple line with a line at the bottom there. That's the deferred annuity strategy versus the next generation product combination. So deferred annuity is doing demonstrably better on income on the upside. And it's, I mean, there's some differences, but there's not a great deal of difference to write home about between the deferred annuitization strategy and the next generation strategy when it comes to the continuing availability of assets during retirement. There are differences, but you know, they're not huge. So bad outcomes, though, is where something like a deferred annuitization strategy does start to suffer. So, but before coming to that, the chart on the far left is the one that drops off first. That is, again, surprisingly, the next generation product. So despite the proposition being that they'll come into their own in under adverse market conditions, this is a fifth percentile outcome. And it does, the gap between it and the annuitisation strategies is not as great, but there is still a gap here. At least it drops off sooner, but in the phase where the guarantee is applying and when the income's dropped away, it's kind of more in the pack, but it is still decaying faster than the annuitisation options. The deferred annuity, though, does get hammered here, because once you've made that bet, you're trying to draw target income from an account-based pension that hasn't performed. You run out of the account-based pension too early before the deferred annuity has kicked in, and it's just there's nothing you can do about that short of changing your target income aspirations in the face of the poor investment markets. I probably won't labour that one too much. Again, it's just how the available assets come out. Although there's a little bit of additional benefit on the asset side from the next generation strategy. So again, there's a bit of a trade that could be done there. Maybe 50-50 is not the optimum combination there. Maybe it's 60-40 or something comparable. But I just want to draw out a few conclusions and then we can wrap up. I mean, the first perhaps obvious statement is no free lunch in any of this. There are some inevitable trade-offs between members' income aspirations and their desire for liquidity, bequests, available assets, flexibility, whatever you want to characterise those things as. There is a trade-off between the form of longevity guarantee and the cost of that guarantee. But I should note that although there's been a lot of debate around compulsion, the annuity rates that we're using in here don't rely on the pricing benefit that might arise from compulsion. Essentially, these prices have been calibrated broadly off quotes from the one annuity provider in the market at the moment. So, you know, it kind of reflects current demographic assumptions within annuity pricing, not the heavier mortality assumptions that might be expected in a compulsory environment. And for the case considered, perhaps the next generation product results are potentially surprising. It does strike us that there are implications here for product pricing and advice prices for next generation products. And in particular, from a product pricing point of view, understanding what your proposition delivers relative to alternative strategies in retirement and judging whether your price point's right for the guarantee that you're offering is obviously an important consideration given what some of this shows. But also, I think the gradual annuitisation delivers some interesting results, but it is at the cost of available assets under good investment conditions, and I'll come back to that in a second. But perhaps one of the strongest messages coming out of this is it really is worth pursuing the tax and regulatory changes that a number in the industry have been lobbying for around deferred annuities and sort of that treatment in CIS regulations. There are a number of others. There's CIS and its implications for tax, but there are also the nasties for those of you that know them within the life company regulatory standards that may, depending on how you structure it, may force you to pay a surrender value on a deferred annuity, which is kind of a contradiction in terms. So that one also gets in the way of pricing here, and we've assumed that's gone away. But a couple of other points. This is only one instance, albeit we particularly wanted to look at perhaps a more typical retirement account balance, $150,000. Some may even argue that's high compared with what you might see in a typical member retiring from an industry fund. But if you... there are dangers from extrapolating here to all other circumstances. Clearly, it's going to vary by retirement balance and the way in which the retirement balance drives a different interaction with the age pension when you are targeting, if you're driving this whole process with a mindset of targeting a particular level of income in retirement. And it'll vary with retirement age. It'll vary with assumed investment mix. But I think the message to... from us would be, I think, the importance of doing this both from a product point of view, product design point of view, but also I'd characterise next generation products as almost in a way going back to the future, where they're bundling up risk again. And so how do you set about comparing what they deliver for retirees, what a bundled solution delivers versus more unbundled solutions, in which I put the annuitisation strategies more in the unbundled camp, or as I hinted at before, given the complexity of the bundled next generation products, just comparing them one against the other. And just on that note, and this, I think this is the last one we wanted to finish on, just really an observation about what I'll term indirect guarantee costs. And there's a lot of subtlety in some of these things that are going on under the bonnet in these products. Just a few wealth warnings, really. The guarantee cost, the guarantee fee, it's clear. You can see what you're paying per annum, and do this sort of analysis, you can see what you might get from that in terms of retirement outcomes. The trickier thing is understanding what might be going on within the fund, that either in the form of techniques to reduce the cost, or to reduce the value and hence the cost of the guarantee, or to deliver what I'll call softer protection, which has an indirect cost. And just to give you a few examples, the Macquarie product has a volatility control within the equity exposures in the fund. That's a very significant aspect of their product design. On average, one would expect a volatility-controlled fund to deliver a lower expected return than a non-volatility-controlled fund. The benefit to doing it is the member or the retiree will essentially indirectly pay for the cost of spikes in volatility in the market, whereas a fund that doesn't have volatility control in it, and you know, the ING, at least the current offering, is a good example of this, the insurers essentially, in return for that guarantee fee, they are really insuring volatility risk. And so a volatility control fund passes some of that risk back to the retiree, and the cost for the retiree is a drag on their investment return on average. Similarly, the sort of emerging idea of putting delta hedging actually within the retiree's fund rather than the insurer simply offering a guarantee and doing delta hedging the guarantee on their balance sheet. Again, the residual cost to the insurer is less there because they're putting more of the cost of, well, guarantee or protection, depending on how you characterise it, back on the retiree, again, through a drag on the investment return that would be expected to arise from running a dynamic hedging strategy. The use of a life cycle fund in retirement is another subtle way of putting part of either lessening the worth of the guarantee or putting the cost of some of that guarantee back on the retiree. Why? Because the nature of the fund is such that as you progress through retirement, you will be taken out of, or have your exposure to growth assets reduced, defensive assets increased. So if you think about what these products are doing, they're saying at the back end of your retirement, there's this floor that will guarantee you some level of income. So by changing that asset mix through the life cycle, it's actually reducing the risk exposures for the provider in offering that guarantee. Again, it's an important point of difference. Then there are some other subtle things around, if there are index funds, is the retiree getting the benefit of the imputation credits on index funds? Clearly, imputation credits are worth a lot to a retiree, given the nil tax treatment of the fund. Are they actually passed on as return to the retiree, or are they used essentially to defray some of the cost of the guarantee? Those are all important subtleties within some of which have already emerged and some you may see in the future. And I guess the important point to make is that whilst that might deliver a lower guarantee fee, it comes at the expense of a lower expected return for the retiree. This analysis hasn't drawn that out. I think in the interest of time, I'll probably stop there just so we've got some time for questions. Thank you.
We've got a roving mic somewhere. Where's the mic? That's a good question. Can you see it anywhere, Darren? Or is Melinda, can you see the... There's supposed to be a mic back here somewhere. Oh, okay, thanks, yeah. You got the job, Darren, thanks. And we've got a mic up here. There's a mic just there, yeah. It's on, yeah.
Good. Nick, we've had this conversation before, but it's about in my mind, the preoccupation with asset price volatility that inclines the investment strategies, particularly for account-based pensions, to be relatively inferior. And that contributes to the early drawdown of the accounts. And to give an example of that, which we've discussed, in the equity market at the present time, you can put together a income-oriented equity portfolio with a gross yield, including franking credits, above 8%. Now, the reason retirees are scared of that is that obviously the asset price volatility is high, but the income volatility is not high. That's the nature of equity investment. So this preoccupation with asset price volatility, I think, is a bad distraction for the investment strategies for account-based pensions, but also with these new generation products, it seems to me, because they're biased towards investment strategies that can be easily hedged, those investment strategies are also going to be inferior for the objective.
Yeah, I comment on that, and we did touch on that in discussions after the session yesterday from some of the product providers. And I think the key point there is that, as anyone who went to that session yesterday will have seen from the charts, that what's happening under the bonnet for these next generation products is exceedingly complex. And obviously what's going on there is they're trying to hedge as many of the risks away as they can. They'll still end up with some residual risks to be owned by the life office, but they're trying to hedge as many of those as they can. So they're looking for asset classes that can be fully hedged, and so that's why it's based on index returns. And to some extent, they are shielding the end investor from any sort of bias that they might be investing in. But so I think that question, and I know Greg, you've had this concept of, well, what about if you adjusted what your growth strategy looks like to deliver a more stable return? I mean, that's something you could look at in the non-guaranteed product, certainly here, because if the retiree doesn't go down the path of these sort of protected products which sort of take that question away from them, then that's the sort of thing they may want to look at.
Yeah, and I guess critically, if you keep your drawdown in line with your sustainable income, you don't have longevity risk. It's a perpetual situation.
Yeah, I think the best illustration I'd give of that is actually the work we did 2 years ago, which was looking at exactly that issue around what is the character of a retiree's longevity risk in Australia, given the sorts of account balances that are out there, given the choices of asset mix, but crucially given the underpin of the age pension. This isn't seeking to get into, again, the sort of ground that this
seeks to be an extension to look at a particular issue of, we've talked about annuitisation strategies, others have. We flagged the issues in earlier work around, well, what are some of the implications of some of the work we've been doing for next generation products as they come online. So our interest here was really about saying, well, we've pondered about it, let's take a look at it and see how the different strategies compare. But by no means do we think this is the end of the story. Barry, I mean, could you just back up one slide on there? No, back up one. That, I mean, there's a whole raft of things that sort of in the, it would be good to get on to do, and sort of I'd encourage others to look at this space as well.
Any other questions? You've got an actuarial heaven, Darren.
Tony Boffinger. I wasn't at the session yesterday, so apologies if this has been addressed. You spoke about sort of hard guarantees versus soft guarantees on the market risk side. On the longevity side, I've heard but have not been able to confirm that, you know, the guarantees on a number of these products on the longevity side are actually quite soft, in that there are discretions available if a cohort of lives has longer than expected lifetimes to reduce benefits. So you're only being insured for your own personal longevity versus cohort longevity rather than an actual hard guarantee on longevity. Are you aware of those?
No, I'm not. That wasn't. I thought you were going to go somewhere differently there, Tony. Happy to be corrected if there's anyone from INGA, Macquarie and AXA in the audience. I haven't seen AXA's product this week, but my understanding of the other two is that it's, in terms of the benefit, it's a hard benefit. It's an insured non-par lifetime annuity style benefit out of a life company for the longevity component. However, both of the products I have in mind, I think they reserve the right to be able to increase fees because of the particular regulations the product sits under. So the benefit is, I think, a hard guarantee for the ones that I'm thinking of, but the guarantee fee is not itself guaranteed, can increase. Now, you need to temper that a little bit, because if the guarantee's gone massively into the money, if you up the guarantee fee, it's a bit of a second order. It doesn't do much for you in those circumstances. But coming back to your specific point about cohorts, I mean, therefore, if you have particular cohorts, there may well be a circumstance where there's opportunity to modestly revise fees, either for, well, obviously for new entrants, conceivably for your whole portfolio of existing business, if you felt it was necessary on account of how you were doing with a particular cohort. But the other point I thought you were going to was the issue around just how, you know, how much for what's being paid, or what's the likelihood of the guarantee actually biting. Certainly my sense from our work in this area is, when you look at the guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit products, then, and you look at all of the risks that the insurer's taking on writing that product, although it's a longevity guarantee product at the back end, that's not the main risk for them. I mean, the market related risks are much more are larger risks in the, if you, kind of the totality of the risk within the product, and they're more front ended than the longevity risk exposure. So it's just the nature of the product.
Sorry, just to ask you, the question of the criteria that you're using, it's one is liquidity and the other is performance under a 95% and 5% the tails. Would I be right to think that the new generation products would perform very much better in the 1% or the 0.5% or the 0.1% tail?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, the further out you go in the tail, I suspect that's where you will see them come more to the fore. I guess the question is, how far out in the tail do you have to go, and how does that feel in terms of benefit for or payoff for the guarantee and the fee that you're paying?
Thank you.
There was a question up on the right-hand side up there. Yeah. And then forward for the next one.
Daniel Levy, PricewaterhouseCoopers. Have you done any work on different asset allocation strategies, low growth, high growth? Because obviously the cost of the guarantee is higher for the higher growth exposure. And any views on how that impacts the sort of worst and best outcome scenarios for the member?
We haven't done any work on that. We backed out the fee that we did use from the products in the marketplace, and as I think Duncan's part mentioned, I mean, they are a sliding scale, at least in one of those products, and so it would be interesting to do that, because you would, you know, lower growth would give you lower return outcomes, but you'd actually be paying less for the guarantee under at least one of the products. As Duncan went through, the other product has what on the surface is a flat fee, but there's other things going on under the bonnet which is really sort of compensating for the flat scale. But that would be one of the areas of further research we'd want to do.
Yeah, I think just to add to that, we had to pitch a ground to cover in 30 minutes. So it's certainly possible to look at those things. It would be something to drill into. Aside from sort of preparing these sorts of sessions, certainly we've done pricing work for clients on the next generation products. So yes, we've certainly looked at the questionable, you know, to what extent does the guarantee vary according to the sort of the asset mixes that are being permitted under the contract. And I mean, you can see that quite clearly from the literature that's out there for the different products, not just the lifetime versions. Certainly INGA's guarantee fees increase as the growth exposure increases. Same is true of AXA's GMAB product. I think Macquarie's the one that's subtly different at the moment, because as Nick says, they're pulling other levers to manage their guarantee cost.
Just in front there. That was a bell before. That wouldn't have been a five-minute bell, would it?
It was 5 minutes early. It was supposed to finish at 26.
That's what I thought, yeah.
Congratulations on some good work. One of your graphs highlight the difficulty of evaluating all these strategies from a customer's point of view in terms of, you know, the probability of survival and downside preferences. If you're saying that you want 26,000, you know, what's the value? How often do you fail to meet your targets, and what's the value of that? And is upside risk valued the same as downside risk, and potentially the value of leaving legacies and things too? So there's some quite interesting, I guess, valuation algorithms to work on to try and work on how to evaluate these strategies. Have you done any work on that, or in trying to line up those strategies, which ones you do? Or?
I would agree with the observation around just the complexity of this. I've yet to see something that's the silver bullet on the illustrations. I know Richard, you did some excellent work 2 years ago for Forum Paper. We were wrestling with some of the similar issues of just how do you get to a point of something that is meaningful yet sufficiently simple to communicate. I suppose my feeling is just, above all else, it's whether this is precisely the sort of precisely a manner in which to convey information like this and in these sorts of forms we do think is extremely important to be able to convey, both in a product design stage and at an advice stage. That was really one of the leftover points in the work that we've done over the last couple of years for the professional gatherings, which is why we wanted to take it a bit of a step further this year and actually sort of properly line up the products and see what they delivered. But you're right. I mean, so available assets are a bit higher, income's a bit lower. Well, what weight do you attach to those two different outcomes? So it's more about informing decisions either at a product stage or an advice stage, to my mind, these are tools to an end. I don't think they deliver the definitive answer to all possible permutations for a provider or a retiree, but I think they're certainly the sorts of ways in which someone should be looking to assess the products and their value proposition.
Sarah, we haven't run out of time, have we? Yeah, we've had two. Okay, well, I thought we had five more minutes to go. Okay, well, I'd like to thank Nick and Duncan for the presentation. It sort of goes some way towards, I mean, I can almost see myself fronting up to sort of sign up to that sort of product. And I think also because what it solves potentially that timing issue too, doesn't it? You know, when do you buy it? So it sort of diversifies timing as well. We've got buying into the market. So based on that presentation, would you like to thank Nick and Duncan? Thank you.